All right, it's Friday and it's several minutes past noon, so it must be time for the PBJ show. Welcome.
PBJ.
I don't think we've started on time in months now, but this is our earliest, our closest to noon start. So I want to congratulate you guys for, I know Steve always has to fluff his hair a little bit.
Yeah, you know.
I got a haircut yesterday afternoon just for the show.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, looking sharp.
I got mine about a week ago.
Yeah, you
kinda,
also
kind of high and tight. Yeah. Little. So speaking of the Navy, yeah. We were just talking. because it is, some people think it's like a military cut, right?
Yeah.
But is Bitcoin, are Bitcoiners pirates or Navy? And you were saying, Max, I think you were saying you wanted to join the Navy.
Hey, man. Don't quote me on that. No, it is. It's an interesting topic. You know, I've thought about more in my life. Not just with Bitcoin, but with everything, right? It's like, you know, I think there are a few tweets out there that were kind of discussing this in general. I think of maybe Chris Pike had an interesting tweet. I like a lot of his stuff, just discussing has tech in general, you know, gone from being the pirates to the Navy. And, you know, I think that's certainly an interesting discussion with Bitcoin as well. And I think it's also an interesting discussion with just like, you know, is this just the way the world works and age? And like, there are certain exceptions, but, you know, most people follow a certain path. And I was joking. I was lifting some new weights yesterday and woke up very, very sore this morning. And so, you know, for what that's worth, I felt kind of old this morning. But, you know, I think the question is applied to Bitcoin is for so much of the early days of this technology, probably like the early days of the internet, you know, it was all about, hey guys, we're here to do something radically new. The system is broken. We're here to come up with a new system. It was extremely cypherpunk, extremely on the edges. Bitcoin got started literally on the edges with things like Silk Road. And, you know, increasingly, we've seen more people discussing, and I think Nick Carter had a tweet you guys were mentioning, and I've seen this with my own friends, like one of my good buddies in Mexico, you know, who was like, hey, I love being a pirate for a long time, but now, you know, I'm like about to get married and have a kid. And like, all of a sudden it's like, I don't know, man, maybe some of this Navy stuff is not so bad. And I think one place we're seeing that is with people discussing, do they really want a self-custody or would they rather just move into ETFs or similar, you know, non-custodial tax advantage things and, yeah, effectively just kind of retire and go their merry way. I think that would be sad if that's what happened to the whole movement. I think some mix of that is probably inevitable. And we also saw, what was it, the $8 billion worth? I don't know if that was confirmed. It was Adam Back or someone else that moved. And I think part of the presumption was it was a conversion from self-custody to ETF. So it definitely seems like that's a hot topic right now.
But those are sometimes, I think those are like the people who are seeding the new Bitcoin treasury company.
Fair
so
enough.
It's not necessarily like anti-self-custody philosophy, but it's more like, this is how you seed a new Bitcoin treasury company, for better or worse, you know, that everybody wants to do that.
Well, and to be clear, I'm not saying any of this is anti-self-custody, but more of just like seeing some of the benefits of not self-custody. And in that case, I mean, it's a different flavor if it's a Bitcoin treasury company, but it is similar, you know, impact.
I think the $8 billion, you're talking about the 80,000 Bitcoin or whatever. That was confirmed that it was sold.
Oh,
it wasn't just transferred.
Never mind.
Now,
yeah, that was a...
Who purchased it, though? How are they custodying it? Unclear.
Yeah.
I think it's a different entity.
Yeah.
Because it was for like estate planning or something.
That's the official word from Galaxy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which apparently is an intentional release from the customer.
I see.
Because otherwise, that's not a normal communication.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the speculation was that the customer wanted to like give some explanation to like calm the market.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. So what do you guys think? Pirates, Navy? And to be clear, even like in traditional tech, right, there are people that are outliers that stay, you know, sort of pirates forever. Like I would argue that I was reading this Buckminster Fuller book Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth, one of my favorite books of all time. And his sort of argument is that in the past, you know, we used to think that it was like the British sort of Navy that was actually ruling the world, but it was never nation states. It was always the great pirates behind them. And that's a fascinating rabbit hole to go down. To give you a flavor of what this might include the owners of the East India Company as an example, right? And, you know, he argued that I think around World War II, the great pirates started dying out because you needed to have enough sort of technological understanding of, you know, different fields, including seafaring, to be able to see that most human laws are in fact quite arbitrary and natural law is like what they were sort of ruled by is Bucky's argument. I would argue that we're seeing a reemergence of the great pirates right now in the AI race. And so some people have stayed pirates. Elon seems like he's, for better or for worse, and I'm not making a normative claim on if being a pirate is good or bad, but at the edges. So it seems like getting rich and old has not made him lose that spark. And I hope enough Bitcoiners keep that too, but
really? I would have gone to him as like one of the most status people out there. I mean, he tried to embed himself with the government. Like,
well, but that's where the claim of Bucky is, that the really, truly great pirates just kind of like take the state from the inside.
Okay.
So,
Steve?
Trojans.
Yeah.
Well, just getting back. I was going to say the collared shirt guy may be among the most cyberpunk.
Actually, he's probably the most cyberpunk person here. For sure.
He's dressing up his
status of the three of us. Now, I mean, getting back to like ETFs, I mean, I heard Nick's comment on his weekly roundup a week ago. And yeah, he just said that, like, I think it was in light of in-kind redemption. So if you could take your Bitcoin that you're self-custodying, put it in an ETF with no tax ramifications, he was just saying that's, you know, maybe attractive to him, might be attractive to a lot of the people. And he also said that we might look back in a few years and just sort of laugh at the silliness and craziness of, like, you know, seed phrases and all the like shenanigans you have to do to try to self-custody. And he also pointed out that people make mistakes and lose their Bitcoin through self-custody. So I, all that's reasonable takes by him. And I even have personal friends who did move their Bitcoin, took the tax it into ETFs to get better security. But I think that would be a worrying trend. If that's like a significant trend, it's a worrying trend. What's the concern there? Well, one, if your Bitcoin is in an ETF, if the in-kind is one directional, you're not two directional, then it becomes this tax trap. You can't get it out without paying a big tax bill.
But I've heard from DK about 75 times that, and one of those times is actually legitimate.
You're one of three Wall Street firms, right? So if you're a big Wall Street firm, you can now do it. Okay. But, you know, and then how are you going to spend your Bitcoin?
Right.
So there's that concern. But we also don't know, is that ever going to take? I mean, we talk about a lot. We're excited about the future of Bitcoin payments and everyday Bitcoin is everyday money. But in a world in which it just stays as a store of value, and then there's a strong trend toward custodians, what does the world of Bitcoin look like? And we talked a little bit about this maybe 2 weeks ago on the show, and we need to keep talking about the importance of this for everyone, even for people who care about Bitcoin as only as an investment. All right. They care about that. Bitcoin becomes a LARP if there's not network activity, because what's the miner incentive to keep securing the network? Today, it is primarily, or I mean, from the beginning of Bitcoin until today, it's primarily the minting of new Bitcoin. But as we all know, that goes to zero. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. So if there's not Bitcoin network activity, it's not just for people who want to see Bitcoin as peer-to-peer cash, but even if you care about Bitcoin security. So we need to talk about that world.
And just to clarify, when you say Bitcoin network activity, you're specifically just, I mean, I think we all know this, but just to clarify, this means not that you got your, you know, brother or cousin involved in Bitcoin and he went to Coinbase and bought some, because that probably generates probably almost no network activity.
Yeah.
But it's when you send Bitcoin from a self-custody wallet to another self-custody wallet that does generate network activity.
Yeah. Actual Bitcoin protocol usage, broadcasting Bitcoin transactions.
Something gets mined.
That's the number that needs to go up well. If that number doesn't go up, then the other number that everyone loves seeing go up will go down eventually. Because then, you know, we'd wind up in a world with no security and it's just like kind of a bogus system.
Yeah.
So now there's many different scenarios where we'll see that activity. It's not like we have to have every human being on the planet, every payment they make being broadcasting on the Bitcoin network. A, it doesn't scale that way. And B, we don't need that level of activity. We just need some. And it could even be a world where no consumers do it, but just merchants. Like there's merchant, like Bitcoin does become everyday money, at least for a portion of the economy. And again, it doesn't have to be the whole economy, just like a slice of the economy, something meaningful, but it could still be relatively niche. But then if there are legitimate transactions going to merchants, some portion of them self-custody, that alone might be sufficient. Or different layer two technologies that support consumer payments. Those systems also can, even if the end consumers aren't custodying their Bitcoin, these like, you know, gateways basically to the network would be self-custody, you know, they'd be self-custodying, they'd be interacting in the Bitcoin network. So
we may just be
many different ways.
We may just be at like a very early stage. I've heard some people hypothesize that it's crazy to imagine consumers using Bitcoin long-term, and it's really the settlement layer for other stuff, almost like a new Swift, and all these other things would be built on top of it, you know, kind of maybe like lightning channels get kind of created and transferred. But like, is it possible that the reason we don't see a lot is because it almost like is not going to grow up to be that, but the layers like Lightning or, you know, some sort of eCash thing or some sort of other data that gets written is really what's going to be the like the mainstream, you know, transactional use cases. And it's really going to be transactions and writing to and from the chain is going to happen more by like a bunch of different entities, but maybe not by an end consumer.
Well, let's talk about a scenario where Bitcoin's only really a store of value, like day-to-day payments. Let's just say that never takes off. So then you have, you know, maybe hundreds or thousands of financial institutions that are holding Bitcoin, transferring Bitcoin. They need to do settlement, sort of like you mentioned, Swift. Is that going to generate enough demand, though? I'm not sure.
It's a good question.
Number one, you know, the Bitcoin handles on the order of 300,000 transactions per day. If you have thousands of financial institutions settling once a day with a bunch of partners or whatever, is it really going to fill up the block space? I don't know. This is one thing we talked about off the air, which is one solution is decrease the block size, which to most people sounds absolutely absurd, right? I mean, like, to, you know, what, 8 years ago, whatever, there was the block size wars and people wanted to increase it to 10 megabytes, 100 megabytes, gigabytes, and increase the block size. One person in the entire space, Luke Dash Jr., wanted to decrease the block size to 300K, like shrink it by 70%. Most people completely dismiss that, but there is definitely logic to it.
Yeah. He was making that argument in 2017?
Yeah.
Okay. Was he making it for the same reason you would make it today? Or
no, his was more like he was focused on IBD time, initial block download, like how fast it would take to sync and like computing resource growth relative to the blockchain growth. And his calculation was that if you reduced it by 70%, then Bitcoin could keep up or, you know, with the pace of technology, and otherwise it would grow too fast.
This, by the way, makes me think of what I think would be two very interesting sort of, I don't know, research papers or academic studies. And maybe some people have done this. I didn't even realize Luke had published something about this. One day, perhaps our economists will actually be looking at Bitcoin and doing actually interesting, useful work. But one question I'd love to see is, I've always kind of had my own mental model of, you know, the rate of growth of the chain versus the cost of consumer hardware and each of the different things, the bandwidth, the storage, and the compute, or whatever you need to run that. I kind of have done my own back of the envelope math. It'd be interesting to see if anyone's done sort of a thorough study of that. I don't know. Are you guys aware of either of those?
No. And I think that's very interesting, but it is orthogonal to the first thing we're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, because this is about centralization concerns, as opposed to like, is there going to be sufficient demand and generate revenue?
Well, and so this gets to the second question, which is more sort of on topic that I would also love to see is, I mean, this is an empirical question, right? So, you know, you basically asked, is there going to be enough transaction volume to give the miners the fees? Well, like, again, for an economist, this is something you could easily model out with different assumptions around value and number of institutions. So, I mean, I think it's going to be a spectrum, right? On the one end of the spectrum, like everything is custody to Coinbase, which is, that seems really, 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 really concerning right now, is if everyone, all the ETFs are using one provider, and I know Fidelity is self-custodying, and I think Anchorage has some adoption, but like, seems like that's a real problem. On the other end of the spectrum, everyone has their own wallet, probably not going to happen. So somewhere in between is where we're going to land. I mean, in the early days, you know, Satoshi himself talked about Bitcoin banks, right? So it's not like it's that, you know, if I just put on my most pragmatist hat, I bet there's some combo where people have individual spending money. Maybe that's eCash. Maybe for some people, it's self-custodial Lightning, or whatever flavor Spark. But I do think that the reality is we're going to see Bitcoin, kind of like you're saying, as more of a settlement layer. For most people, there will be some sovereign individuals or, you know, the great pirates that are playing themselves. Great. But most people will probably still have financial institutions because, like, again, I think Nick has a great point. It's like, if you have your whole life savings and you like just fuck up a word or something, like that's like once you start having kids and stuff, that's really not a risk people want to take. And I think the interesting question to me is how many financial institutions do you need to keep the network sufficiently decentralized? I don't know. Is the answer 10? Is it 1,000, 100,000, a million? Like,
not 10, but yeah. Let's talk about that. But I wanted to second your call out for economists to engage here. I'd love to see better modeling. I think it's impossible to completely model it, but like, yeah. You know, don't let the perfect be the enemy of good. I think
right.
Creating some better modeling would be interesting. But as far as like what the world, yeah, we definitely don't need a world where every human is self-custodying and transacting. But, you know, I think a world in which somehow eCash takes off and there's like hundreds of thousands of mints around the world, that probably alone would be enough activity and demand. But if it's just the, you know, 4,000 traditional financial institutions in the world that are doing it, I do worry that there wouldn't be enough demand. Mm-hmm. So we'd have to reduce the block size. Mm-hmm. Because just so everyone understands why that's the case, the way the fees work on Bitcoin, it's not like miners can't, the protocol is not going to insist on like a minimum fee. And although having said that, currently, or because Bitcoin consensus, there's no minimum fee. Bitcoin core relay policy right now does have a minimum fee of 1 sat per V-byte. And in fact, that's a current discussion right now because miners are starting to mine transactions that are below 1 sat per V-byte fee.
How is that possible?
Because it's consensus valid.
So even if you do, can you do like 0.1 right now?
Yep. We're seeing that.
Was the distinction you said? Relay?
So just like the whole op return debacle, there's a difference between standardness rules and what Bitcoin Core, one implementation of Bitcoin's policies are to relay a transaction on the network, and consensus. There's a delta there. And so just because something isn't relayed by default by Bitcoin Core doesn't mean it can't be mined. Just like people mining like a Donald Trump JPEG taking up the entire 4 megabytes in the space in the block or whatever, you can't relay that through Bitcoin Core by default, but it can get mined because it's consensus valid. Mm. So there is no minimum fee.
Interesting.
And it's just it's a free market, right? Like you as a miner, you might insist on like, I'm not going to mine a transaction unless it pays me a certain fee rate, but I can come online and undercut you, right?
Exactly.
And DK can come on and it can go to zero,
right?
So even if you have, so it's disconnected from willingness to pay.
Yeah.
So like you could be a financial institution transferring $1 billion where you'd be like more than happy to spend thousands of dollars on fees to ensure the security of this payment to your adversary, maybe.
Yeah.
Paying like a oil fee between two adversarial countries or something, you'd be more than happy to spend a huge fee. But if you don't need to, why would you? So if there's not sufficient demand, if the market overall is not saying, here's the minimum fee, you're not going to pay that. So that would be the rationale for decreasing the block size. If it turns out that the only people trying to transact are these big financial institutions with large amount transfers, and if you did shrink the block size to make sure that the demand exceeded the block space, then you'd see actual economic willingness to pay play out.
Okay. So I'd like to go through two scenarios. Let's say there's one scenario where we have roughly the same number of financial institutions that we have today, 4,000 or whatever that number is. If the price of Bitcoin is high enough, couldn't that still work? Like if they're paying Bitcoin's $10 million a coin. Yes, they're only doing a few transactions a day, but they're paying, I don't know, huge amount. I guess.
I don't see how it's related to the price of Bitcoin though. Because let's say, so if there's 300,000 transactions that can be sent in a day, if there's only demand for 250,000, then the transaction fees will be zero.
They'll be zero. That's a good point.
Or, you know, like.
So it's
one sat.
Have we ever been in an environment that you would consider sort of like healthy transaction fee market? Because I feel like I've seen it spike.
When the spammers are here.
Well, I've seen a spike and decrease, but
no, there's only, it's never been. I mean, this also gets to a topic. We should also, well, but okay. So two things. another thing we should discuss is security budget. Like, how much is even needed? Because we can't say history is the guide. Because history has nothing to do with like what actually is needed for security. It's completely driven by the price of Bitcoin. Because it's a fixed amount of Bitcoin that's minted each block. So the only variable is the price of Bitcoin, which has nothing to do with security. It's all about demand for owning Bitcoin, right? So in the future, when that minting goes away, it flips to a completely different system. Then it is demand-based for to get your transactions into the block, also having nothing to do with security. So this is arguably a flaw in the entire system. That the point of the fee is security,
right?
But it is not tied to the actual activity. No one's paying a fee for security. They're paying a fee to get their transaction mined.
Right.
Why is that a flaw, though? I mean, it's a second order consequence. Like,
well, because let's say that we knew the security budget needed for Bitcoin was $50 billion a year.
Right.
Let's just say
the security budget, you mean how much has to get paid out in globally to miners in order to keep them wanting to run it?
To participate. Yeah, and prevent 51% attacks. Yep. Like sufficient security defense. So let's just say, we don't know that, and we can talk about that, but let's just say that is actually the case. $50 billion a year. But, so obviously, if we're only paying, like if we don't get Bitcoin network activity and we're only paying $1 billion a year, then we are at risk of 51% attacks, double spending, and the whole system failing. What if it's the flip, though? Let's say that the security budget is actually only needs to be $1 billion, and we're spending $50 billion a year or $500 billion a year because there's so much demand.
Right.
Then that's just like a stupid economic loss. Like, it's just friction in the economy, unnecessary friction, because we're paying 500 times more than we need to for the security we need. And number one, we do not know how much security we need, and we can go into why that's such a hard problem to model and understand. And number two, even if we did know, the way Bitcoin works is not aligned with that.
Okay, so just to, I don't know if pushback is right, but the way that I think about this is in a complex adaptive system, like, and this is the reason I'm not worried about in the long run. The security, like, I think security almost is perhaps the wrong question to ask. The question to start with is like, I mean, is it providing value or not? And so the way I think about it is when we say how much security is in need, well, that depends on how much value people are moving, and how much value people are moving depends on how much value they get out of it. So let's say we said $50 billion for all of today's financial institutions. Well, if they're not getting enough value out of that, then I think what would happen is there would still be a security budget. It would just come way down. So maybe it's $1 billion. And then who's still using it then? Well, you know, the dark web, Silk Road, the edges of the internet, and it kind of goes back into another dark age and then maybe perhaps reemerges. So I guess it's almost like, to me, the fundamental question is, are people getting value out of it or not? If they're getting value, they'll pay. And then security is like a second order effect of that. That's the way I think about it.
Are there any proposals for how you might correct this? Like, I mean, something like a dynamic block size comes to mind. Is that, it sounds crazy, but...
No, there's been some thinking around that. And actually, Jameson Lopp just interviewed with Haley in the studio on 21 and 21, and he's sketching out a proposal on that. I know AJ Towns is another developer who's done some thinking around this, and it was certainly proposed in the past before. But I do think that's an area ripe for even deeper exploration. That feels like it solves the problem I'm mentioning. Because even with what you said, my interpretation of what you said, Max, is like it speaks to the difficulty adjustment.
Yes.
But I still think that's orthogonal to what I'm saying. I'm saying that like whatever the security budget is, like the people's willingness to pay, they're not paying for security. They're paying to get the transaction mined. Mm-hmm. Right. In other words, let's say that we needed... in a given block, let's say we needed $1 million to make sure that's secure. That's how the math works out. But there's just not enough demand. So you can get away with paying a penny to get your transaction in. Mm-hmm. Are you going to be altruistic and pay, you know, $1 million divided by 3,000 transactions. So like, you know, 300, are you going to pay $333 because you know that's how much security is needed? Or are you going to pay a penny because you know that is going to get your transaction mined? And like, well, you know what the answer is.
No, it's a good point. I guess what I would say that, and I need to think more about this because the adaptive block size is an interesting question. But to that first question, I would just say that Bitcoin's not valuable enough to like move $1 million or like whatever amount you're trying to move. It's not the right tool in that world.
Let's play that out.
Yeah.
So let's say that, let's say like Michael Saylor's dream comes true. Bitcoin's like $43 million a coin. It's like hundreds of trillions of dollars of value. It sucks up real estate and bonds and everything. Let's say all that happens. And it actually is, it's like true, it's real, it's sustainable. That's how things are working. So there's like real value delivered to the world. Let's just assume all that's true.
Right.
Okay. But it's all just custody at Coinbase.
It's all paper.
So there's literally no network activity or very little, like a few institutions sending money back and forth. Again, so there'd be like tremendous value for the world. It's one that, but well, and also let's say even payment, let's say also everyday payments takes off, but it's just like one company that, or a handful of companies dominate, like Lightspark and Coinbase and Block or whatever. Let's say they dominate payments. Then if there's, so they're just tremendous value for the world, but there's not enough Bitcoin network activity. So again, it's detached.
Well, so what I would argue in that world is that Bitcoin's value actually like went down by like 99%. And so what happened in
that's
that
why world, we're talking about in the show. Well, exactly. I totally agree. And that's why I think investors who only care about number go up, which is totally fine, that's all you care about, they also need to worry about the Bitcoin network activity growing.
100%. But to be clear, my argument there is, again, like you would have a nominal value where you say this is extremely valuable for the world, but the real market value, like what people are willing to pay, actually just fell 99.999%. And it was like, it was a strategic takeover. And that's how the quote unquote state won.
Well, that's why I call it, you know, I've called on the show like a LARP or like XRP. I think it evolves into that because it's just like kind of bullshit at that point.
Exactly.
It's like we had this conception of Bitcoin being differentiated from all the other tokens and
that's how Bitcoin dies short term.
Yeah.
Again, it would never die. So my argument is this would be like a generational thing where there would still be
into the caves.
Adam back is, kind of jokingly, but like, yeah, there will be some class of hardcore cyberpunks that will never stop. And so, I mean, it wasn't he the one that famously said he put the stop order or whatever that he would buy all Bitcoin at like 0.01 cents or a penny, whatever.
But I'm happy to sign up for that.
Yeah, exactly. But my point is like
is it all going to go?
I've got my stop order in for a penny.
Exactly, a penny of coin. And when we say a coin, we mean the old world Big B Bitcoin too, right? Mm-hmm. Like so. In that world, I think what would just happen is you'd have Bitcoin would go underground for a generation again, and the status would be like, oh, cool, we won, and then you would just go back and forth.
But to be clear, but I think there's two threads for us to be that we are discussing and that we need to just keep discussing. One is if there's not enough Bitcoin network activity, Bitcoin dies eventually. Well, you said 2 years, but I think it's more like 20 years. But either way, we need to
be talking
about it. Yeah, we need to talk about it now. That's one thing. But even if we live in a world where awesome Bitcoin is everyday money takes off and like self custody is valued, even if it's by merchants or intermediaries, or there's like millions of financial quote institutions, maybe they're like self-sovereign like e-cash mints that are like NIMS or whatever, AI agents or whatever, but there's millions of these, and then there's lots of network activity. Let's say all that actually happens, great, then one thread that we're discussing is solved. There's tons of network activity, but the second thread is it's still the economic activity on the blockchain is not a direct function of the security needed.
Okay.
Maybe it's a who cares.
Yeah.
If enough money is paid.
Exactly. That's my point.
We don't know. The only way we know how much we need is when we start getting attacked.
Exactly.
And like that could happen. That's a possible future. It dips so low that it gets attacked. And then we're like, okay, well, that's too low. Again, we can't be like, okay, everyone pay up more. But we'd learn what it is. If we never learn what it is, we don't know what the threshold is. As long as we stay above the threshold, maybe we're 10% above, maybe we're 100x above, then we'd be fine from a security perspective. Then it's just unnecessary economic friction. But I do think more exploration around dynamic block sizes is warranted. Maybe Spiral should fund this.
It's a good question.
Like, take an action item. I still think we need AI note taking during our show to give me action items.
Dear agent, please.
But the dynamic blocks, let's say there was a proposal or a hypothesis that seemed to make sense. Do you suspect that such a thing would get a lot of pushback from certain players? Like, I can imagine the miners be like, hell yeah, like more transaction fees sounds good. I can imagine that, you know, maybe gut reaction from investors would be, I guess, a little bit kind of who cares? Like, if they're not spending it anyway, why do they care if they're just holding? So who would be
Well, first of all, there'd be people who around 10 years ago might be have an aversion to this just because it was like such a nasty fight then, and they don't want to even want to broach the topic of changing the block size in any way. But whatever, we can get, I mean, if it's like a legitimate discussion and potentially needed, we'll get over that. As far as the other stakeholders, you know, their reaction to it, well, I think it's a function of two things. One, I mean, how good is the proposal? Like, it needs, it does need to be evaluated along numerous angles. I mean, technically, does it work? Adversarially, can it be attacked? And that needs huge scrutiny, because this kind of change could accidentally open up some vulnerability that can be attacked. So it needs like heavy scrutiny, technical scrutiny. And then economically, back to the point of like, let's get some economists focused on modern future money.
Exactly.
Like, I still don't understand why.
I know, it's crazy.
Economists at universities don't do this.
The universities are part of the fiat system.
It's such a novel, interesting challenge and problem. I think
you're not going to get tenure doing
that. Intellectually so interesting, right? So
I think you need kind of an indie econ hacker.
That would be something cool for Spiral to fund, is like indie economists. Because the people at the institutions, they care about tenure. Again, incentives. Yeah. Incentives rule the world. Like, they're not going to take the risk to study something that might get them like fired.
Yeah, we'll do it.
So indie economists,
I'm committing to grants for that. But also a goal for...
how much free money did Steve give away on the show today?
Yeah, we're up to a million.
can I get some of those sweet, sweet sass, please?
Look under your chair.
Key.
But Presidio Bitcoin also has a goal like bridging the gap between Silicon Valley, right? And Silicon Valley doesn't just mean Google or venture capitalists, but also universities like Stanford and Berkeley and local universities. And eventually trying to crack that nut for like the whole world. Like, hopefully we can have success here in the Bay Area. And then maybe that's a template for others to learn from around the world.
I love it.
And not just computer science students, but also economists.
Although, to be fair, the computer science students are probably better at this.
And everybody studies computer science these days. Do you know that?
Exactly.
I think like 70 or 80% of the Stanford class is computer science.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's like kind of ridiculous.
And they're about to all be like, out of jobs.
Literally?
I think so. I mean, maybe the number is 60%, but it's not like, I don't know.
The majority of the entire student base is
Everybody studies computer science.
Meaning like as a minor? Or
it's like their major. I think everybody studies computer
science.
I think it's more than 50%. I don't know what the number is, but it's... Yeah,
I know it's high, but that's that's very high.
Well, I'll fact check it. Don't take my word for it.
Right. Well, even if it was 20%, I think that's what?
Kind of crazy. Yeah. So, okay, two thoughts that came out of that. One, on the adaptive block size thing. So my initial reaction is, you know, I think part of what makes Bitcoin so beautiful is simplicity, right? So like I'm kind of like initially allergic to anything, to your point, because again, complex adaptive system, it's very hard to model. Like, I think it's awesome. We should definitely have people studying it, do as much work as humanly possible, testnet, whatever. But again, my fear is always like anytime you met, like the reason Bitcoin took off in my mind and so many reasons is Satoshi said, okay, like having a decentralized marketplace was basically having like decentralized bids and asks was impossible. Something we've talked a lot about.
Yeah.
So instead he just says, okay, cool. We're going to give away whatever, a fixed amount. There's a fixed supply and we give away a fixed amount for block size reward. And that just solved the problem with simplicity. So anytime we mess with simplicity,
it's all the problem, but it has a flaw, and you could argue it might be a fatal flaw.
Totally, totally. And again, I'm very supportive of studying. I'm just saying in general, in my old age, I'm becoming more concerned.
I'm
more
for simplicity. I agree with the simplicity point.
The second thing, though, is like there are empirical things to study here. So the Monero community already has this. So they argued this like forever ago. And the Monero community, people think of it as a privacy, you know, coin or whatever, but it actually has two very interesting innovations or experiments that are very similar to Bitcoin. One is it has an eternal tail emission, which is something interesting. I know Peter Todd and other people have called for that. It's like it starts as 1% and then it's a fixed amount. So it goes, it's asymptotic with zero, but never zero. And the second thing is they also have adaptive block size. They also have like this like thing to like prevent ASICs from mining, which I think is like extremely dumb.
Yeah.
But
dumb, interesting, dumb is my quick response to those three things.
Agreed. So, but the point is like Monero is a real network. It does have real volume. It is the currency of the dark web. Probably worth, if I were like a renegade economist applying for Steve's money, I'd probably start with there. And yeah, it would be fun. So
actually, let's go through those. I'm already forgetting the three things. So yeah. Tail mission. Actually, that's a big topic. So let's dive into that in a second. But the third, your number three, I think is dumb. That's where they try to stay ahead of the ASIC development.
So dumb.
Right.
By hard forking every 6 months and changing the algorithm. I mean, I thought that's dumb for
who gets to decide what your algorithm is.
It's very centralizing force, right? So it's a handful of core devs.
Yeah,
get it.
The high priest.
They get it. The high priest get to decide the rules of Monero every 6 months. And I'm sure from the day they started that until now, I'm sure they're earnest and honest and have made good decisions and nothing nefarious. But what about the next set of developers that come in, right?
Well, and also, I mean, you guys have heard me make this, you know, call over and over and over, and hopefully we'll talk more about mining and stuff. But like, to me, Bitcoin is energy-backed money, power-backed money, full stop. If you get rid of the energy, you've gotten rid of the system. I would argue that Monero actually could, I wouldn't say necessarily overtake Bitcoin because there's such strong network effects from back in the day, but it had a shot to like, I mean, it's got the real adoption on the dark web, right? Like to actually be something with staying power, except for that one, in my opinion, super dumb decision.
Now, what's the first thing you said? Remind me again.
Tail mission.
Your tail mission, yeah. Let's talk about that, because I think
that was your dumb.
I think that's dumb as well.
Dumb. Yeah, okay.
Not as dumb as the other thing, but dumb.
Not as dumb as the other thing.
Dumb to introduce it, or dumb if it were created that way?
Well, let's get into that, because we've talked about that. I think we agree, but let's talk about it live here, see what Max... So, I think, and I'm pretty sure DK totally agrees with me, the most important thing about Bitcoin and its like monetary policy is that whatever it started with, it's consistent, doesn't change, and is predictable. And like, there's high confidence that like the game theory and system works out so that there's high confidence among everyone that in 20 years, 40 years, 60 years, it's going to be the same.
Right.
And then we can plan around that. That's the most important thing. So whether it started with 21 million coins or 42 million coins, or whether it had a tail emission or not, it is like second order. The most important thing is that it stays certainty. Consistent and the certainty. So that doesn't even really seem that debatable. However, at this point, whatever it is, to change it now strikes at the heart of what it sounds like we're agreeing is the most important thing. So first of all, I would argue adding a tail emission isn't even better, but let's say it is better. Then but changing it just strikes at the most important thing. So it's a bad idea at this juncture.
And when you say tail emission, just to clarify, that's that it doesn't in whatever 2140 or whatever, it doesn't stop having a block reward,
right.
But it continues having a block reward after that point.
And the way that Monero does it is it starts off as 1% of the total supply in the first year, and then it's a fixed
of the total
amount.
Supply of the entire.
Yeah, so I don't know how many coins are, but let's say it's whatever, you 21 million or whatever, and then like you take 1% of that, and I forget the exact details of how they do it, but they keep it as a fixed number. So as a percentage of the supply, it goes.
What is fixed? The percentage is fixed or the amount is fixed?
The amount is how
that's also
it's been
dumb.
A long time. Yeah.
Because it's literally the same thing
in the
long run. Right?
I could
because
be wrong. Like if you don't quote me on that.
No,
like
I think you're right. I definitely know many systems do choose that.
Right.
And I think that is so stupid because all it does is just defer the problem.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, if it's a fixed amount, then it becomes 0% eventually.
Yeah, effectively 0%. Yeah,
effectively zero. Yeah, I mean, like 1 divided by 2 to the 256 is effectively zero, right?
Yeah.
So that's a dumb system. It would need to be a fixed percentage or something more advanced than a fixed absolute
just
amount,
hard coded number.
but also let's talk about the differences there. So the question is, do you want So someone has to pay for the security of the system. Who's paying the decentralized bank, the miners, the ones that are doing transaction selection? Who's paying for that? The way Bitcoin's set up, is that it's transactors. So if you want to transact, you have to pay. If you're just saving, you don't have, I mean, you had to pay up front, maybe. Either if you're self-custodying, you pay up front and then you never have to pay again. Or if you're relying on a third party, you pay just a tiny sliver of what's needed. And then you never have to pay again. Whereas if you're a transactor using it as everyday money, then you are you're securing the system on a daily basis. We can argue whether that's good or bad or how it's aligned or whatever. Now, with a tail emission where you keep inflating the supply, everyone's paying, right? Because everyone who holds the coin...
I think I've heard of this somewhere before. Like, ideally, you aim for about 2% per year.
Yeah.
You could have a basket of goods to measure it slightly differently, though.
You can change the basket whenever you want.
But yeah, so, well, everyone pays, although if we simplify and say there's two categories of users, like the people with the wealth and saving and then people who are just spending. And let's say, just to simplify, the spenders are just earning their paycheck each week and spending it out on Bitcoin. They have no savings. So I'd say that the real cost then is borne by the with tail emission is borne by the people holders. The holders, yeah. The people with the wealth. So it's interesting, like, that's two very different philosophies, right? Do you tax the people spending or do you tax the people who have the wealth?
Well, it's income tax versus capital gains tax.
Right?
Well, we kind of have that system, right?
And and today's Bitcoin setup is income tax.
Purely income tax and no capital gains tax.
And I would argue it's actually a little bit of a reverse of the system. It's like the system that we have in name, but not in practice, right? So, like, I always think of a meme that Justin Moon shared where it showed the Federal Reserve and it showed Robin Hood and it said steals from the rich and gives to the poor. It showed the Federal Reserve and said steals from the poor and gives to the rich. And then it showed Bitcoin and said doesn't steal, which I think sums it up perfectly.
Well, but maybe, I mean, we're talking about is doing that. But also, I'd say it's not like capital gains tax, because capital gains is only when you choose to create a tax event by trading. It's more like a wealth tax.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So tail emission is a wealth tax. Right. Where, like, I do nothing and I'm getting.
And this is my point. The current system in name, in theory, you sell things, but in, like we've talked about, you know, and again, I'm happy things like Lava give the superpower to everyone, but it's, you know, in practice, wealthy people don't actually sell things. They just get loans. And so, in this system, wealthy people actually get taxed.
So I think, and I'm not sure there's like, I don't think, even if the three of us debate it and try to get to a conclusion, I don't think there's like a right answer to that. Like, who pays? We can talk about the trade-offs and like economic system. And again, we could, you know, get a bunch of economists to think about this problem.
But I kind of like the Justin Moon meme, just doesn't steal. It's a good one. I get it. And like,
but help me understand again, like what does that mean in relation to the current Bitcoin system? Means the people paying for the system are the people spending their money daily.
Totally.
There could be this alternative system in which the wealthy people are paying. It's one or the other.
Yeah.
So what do you mean? It's quote stealing from one of these two groups.
Well, it's not stealing. If you actually need to use the service, I know you could argue is saving the use case that you're willing to pay for it. And I suppose that's like an argument, but like,
but if you're saving, like, then you're not paying, you amortize the cost of the one transaction.
He's saying that maybe saving isn't using, but saving definitely is. I mean, now it is the use case. It's the, like, people aren't, it's a niche to spend. So like, I would argue strongly that saving is a use case.
Yeah.
So like, and that's where the value is today. It might be where, I mean, and I fully expect it to be where the value is in the future. It might be where all the value is in the future.
So I would argue that actually opens an attack vector for Bitcoin. Excuse me, to get outcompeted by something that doesn't tax the holders. Like, just play this out for a minute. Let's say, I'm not saying
Bitcoin doesn't tax the holders.
Right. But in this new world where you have like the tail emission, which is effectively a wealth tax, I think that potentially opens the door for something like Bitcoin to arise again, where it's like, if you are storing your wealth in Bitcoin or you're storing your wealth in this, like, imagine there's a hard fork. One fork taxes you to store, one fork doesn't tax you to store. As like a wealthy person, I kind of know which one you're going to choose, right? Unless you think that with
depends if you believe I don't depends know. On what you think everybody else is going to do.
Yeah.
Well, but also like,
and is the budget
let's put our, let's say we are, We're wealthy savers. We're that in that camp. And then the day comes where it's like 20 years from now, there's still no Bitcoin network activity. So everyone's freaking out. right? Because there's not enough to pay for Bitcoin. So there's like the volume has been cranked up 100x on the we need to add tail emission. So on one hand, no, we don't want it because we don't want to be taxed. But on the other hand, we lose our entire investment because the whole system fails. Yeah. So I think I'd rather be taxed than I'd rather lose.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, whatever, 10 basis points per year, then lose 100% of my money.
And one could argue that at least this is a quote unquote a fair tax, right? It's not like, okay, it's being funneled through some bureaucracy that goes to fund wars or whatever. It's like, okay, you can see exactly what you're being taxed. So
to be clear, just for the audience, I'm not taking a position on this and I'm not arguing that we should do this. Yeah. I'm just saying
Steve is pro tax.
Yeah. I think it's under discussed. I think we're on a path where it will be discussed a lot more because there'll be concerns about who's paying for the mining security. And so it needs to be discussed more.
I agree. This should all be discussed more. We should see the renegade economist. I'd love to see that. However, I don't know. It's just my gut. But like somehow I'm still just not worried. Like I just think I trust. And yes, we should always push for it. But that there will be one of two things, either like mass adoption for payments at some point, because we'll actually have services that you can only get there, whether that's in the gray edges or AI agents or whatever, or we're going to see enough financial institutions that it kind of solves itself. To me, that's a very interesting question. So let's assume for a minute you don't get the mass transaction case, or at least it takes a long time. So again, the renegade economist can maybe give us a better number. So we agree, you know, based on what you were saying, if there's 3,000 transactions a day, there's 4,000 current financial institutions, probably 4,000 is too low to...
300,000, right?
Yeah, but 4,000 individual institutions, 300,000 transactions a day, 4,000 is probably too low. So let's just say there's some number of institutions that are like regularly transacting with each other. And let's say there'll always be some sovereign individuals, but just for the sake of this, it's like 99% or 90% institutions. So let's say at least an order of magnitude more institutions is necessary. And obviously the more, the better. So if you have 40,000 that are settling up with each other, you could, in theory, you know, hopefully clear that 300,000 transaction per day hurdle. Obviously 400,000 would be better. 4 million would be better. Like the higher up you go, but probably at least 40,000 in terms of order of magnitude. Now, my big question is, what can we be doing? And I actually, I don't want to spill the beans on any companies that we've all been talking with, but what can we be doing to see, or let me phrase this another way. What are the incentives that would encourage at least 40,000 eCash mints as an example that are getting everyone to say, I don't want to use, you know, JP Morgan or Fidelity or whatever, the big guys. I want to use this smaller institution. Like, how do we basically see a true resurgence of free banking on steroids? Because I think that's probably enough to get us what we want.
Well, I think also let's talk, there's the TradFi and regulated class, let's say, and then there's not that.
Yeah.
Another concern with traditional financial institutions is that they're very accustomed to signing legal agreements with partners, right? And if you do that, and you have it, and you trust the legal agreement, and you trust your partner, you don't even need to use the Bitcoin network. You can just transfer value back and forth between each other on the Lightning network, or even your own proprietary technology. Yeah. If somehow the Lightning network doesn't work for you,
although it's
even if there's thousands of traditional financial institutions, a lot of their activity, even that doesn't have to hit the Bitcoin network. If fees rise too much.
Yeah.
Again, obviously they're paying a penny for the incredible value the Bitcoin network provides, or even like $100 for like large transfers, they won't bat an eye. Of course they'll use that. But if it rises too high beyond their willingness to pay, they'll just substitute with another system.
So we don't know what the exact number is, but let's just say, you know, we want at least 40,000, 400,000, 4 million financial institutions that people are choosing. I guess the question I pose is, why is I as an individual would prefer to use, as an example, my local credit union versus Wells Fargo or a larger bank? One of the theses that we saw a couple of years ago from the FedEmint sort of side was, hey, you could have like a local, you know, whatever, community members that are custodying your money. Maybe there's some reason you want to keep the money local to the community, or you trust these people because in your town. I've always been very skeptical that you would want like the random like butcher or whatever being one of your signatories on your money. So I'm skeptical on like the super, super local community thing. I am more bullish though on this idea that I'm not exactly sure what's going to be the winning feature here, but that like you would rather a credit union where it's you and like the 10,000 people that you see every day versus some bank that's, you know, whatever, 10,000 miles away. what do you guys think are the incentives that get us, you know, let's say at least 4 million of these eCash mints or new version credit unions versus big banks?
Well, I think trust, you know, as much as we talk about trustlessness, when you talk about a bank, you're establishing a trust relationship. Yeah. But that's not a self-custody thing. So I think whenever you're establishing trust, you'd rather first trust yourself, then trust your family, then trust your neighborhood and community and town and whatever, you know. So I think it's just sort of concentric circle expansion. And so,
well, to be clear, I would much rather trust people that I can talk to, but probably not just like the local random community. Cause I like, again, self-cut, like someone like loses their seed phrase or something, like that's huge. I'd rather trust a professional that I can like interact with.
Right, but like you can't talk to Sam Bankman-Fried, but you might be able to talk to,
yeah,
you know, if Steve were running.
Yeah, that's true. To me, it greatly matters your, like, which country or jurisdiction you're in.
Yeah.
So if you're in a jurisdiction in which the legal system, the banking system is relatively good, like the United States, then I think most people in the US would prefer to use a bank than like local community members. Yeah. It's like, what's the best way to like ruin family or friend,
yeah,
your community relationships is money.
Like, yeah.
I lend David money. I don't get it back and it ruins our relationship, right? I
mean, that DK over there.
Deadbeat.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's as old as time.
Right.
Like that kind of human dynamic. So, if you aren't having major issues, mm-hmm, with your bank, I think you choose bank. But there are many places in the world where there's low trust in institutions, whether it be your government, your legal system, your banking system, and there, you know, it's a totally different answer.
But to be clear, I think there's a spectrum. I 100% agree with you. Like, I'm not trusting like the random people in my community to custody the money. However, if it's someone that is a professional, like let's say, you know, I don't know, where PB and Alex started a bank or whatever, it's like, well, I know he's doing this full time. There's investors back. Like, it's a real deal, but like I can like chat with him on a day-to-day basis, IRL. That to me is important. And I also think you might see, even in the United States, right? Like even in the United States, I would prefer to be able to like call my banker than like have like an automated system or someone in New York City. I think that could be enough, but I also think there might be other like other incentives. Like imagine for a minute, you know, if you had a, you know, one of these credit unions where I give them, you know, whatever, my money, my Bitcoin, they custody it. But also I know they're more inclined to give out loans like in the place that I live. Maybe that's also enough where it's like, I want to encourage like, okay, like the place where I live to thrive and, you know.
Or you might even just be able to assess what a loan risk is in, yeah, a way that like a big national one can't, right? Yeah. Like you might know something specific about the geography or the real estate or your weird employment thing that's actually very good, but doesn't look good to the national purview, right?
Or Steve gave him the skinny on DK.
Don't trust that guy.
Come on. Just don't.
Yeah, I think those are, you're pointing out good reasons. So I, you know, there's several different ways I could imagine eCash mints taking off. They're all highly speculative,
yeah,
and lowish probability,
yeah,
I think, but possible.
Yeah.
And then if they do, that would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
Same way with like, you know, Lightning Network, Lightning nodes, taking off, or Spark or Arc. There's, you know, a myriad of layer two technologies. If any of them take off because people actually want to do payments, that's a good thing.
Yeah. But to me, the key again is whatever the technology is, like we just don't want, you know, a small cabal running all of it. Like to me, there's a spectrum between one company and like everyone in the world. And like, you know, it's probably gonna be somewhere in the middle. The closer we get here, the better.
That's why net. I mean, I agree with your net. I still believe that we're on that in the future, there will be sufficient demand for the properties of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Meaning that people will want to do Bitcoin transactions for the trust minimization in that transaction, that will then generate enough revenue to secure the network.
Yeah.
And even though it's going to be a mystery what the security budget needs to be, we'll be above that.
Yeah.
I do actually believe that's still going to happen. But it's definitely not a certainty.
Yeah.
We really have no idea what the probability of that is. And when I see, it's a disturbing trend when we see more and more people like making comments like Nick did. And again, definitely not shading Nick at all. I agree with his point.
Yeah. It's a fair.
But like DK and I have a mutual friend who moved his, like half his Bitcoin into an ETF because it gives them more peace of mind.
I have multiple friends that have done that.
So that's just, so I understand in the near term, the logic and rationale behind it. I worry about that trend long term if we don't see reasons to increase the Bitcoin network activity.
So it always comes back to, we need reasons to use Bitcoin.
And the reasons are probably going to come, I'm going to say it again, but probably going to be new applications, new things, not the existing stuff we have changing to Bitcoin, but new things that get discovered, invented, created.
100%.
And I think we've got a lot of people out there vibe coding today. We've got a builder product.
In this very building.
Right, we've got a builder once a month meetup where we actually talk about these things. So I think we...
Not just talk. Show.
Show. Yeah. Yeah. Actually make,
build.
Right?
Yeah. Make and show.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm cool. Not going to name names because I think it's against the rules, but we saw somebody...
Now we can.
Well,
because we want to get in a...
We live stream.
We weren't set up yet, but we are going to live stream demos showcases. So I think it's okay to out people who...
Okay. Well, I was just going to mention Matt sort of from scratch built something in front of us, like with from the prompt to the actual working software. And I think that's the kind of stuff when we see what can be done and it's easy. I mean, we see which exact prompt we need to use to get the Lexi wallet installed. I think that's the thing that helps these new things come to life.
Yeah.
And actually, by the way, we probably shouldn't commit to this because I don't know how regular it will be, but Matt, and I did Matt tell you, or were you on the thread where Matt and I were talking about this?
I didn't hear about this, but I have an idea where this is going.
The other day I tweeted, it's some other conversation I was having. I tweeted out, I was like, why start a podcast when you can start a Vibecast? And Matt comes back to me, he's like, let's do it. And I was like, do what? I was just like, I was just like shitposting. I didn't really have something in mind. So, so we have a document right now of some of our favorite ideas that we want to build. Some of them Bitcoin related, some of them not. But it's just stuff that we think we could create on a live stream in about an hour, probably going to use Replit and try to go from like scratch to a production deployed thing on a live stream in about an hour.
I love it.
And we're going to do this. I think we're going to start sometime this coming week. I don't think we have a specific date and time planned yet, but
let's go.
But yeah, we're going to do that. So I think that'll be another effort toward the sort of builder ethos.
By the way, real quick, our producer let us know a while ago, 20% of kids at Stanford graduate with a CS degree, but 95% take at least one CS class.
Okay. So maybe I got the stat from somebody who was a little less precise about their...
Even 20% is like remarkable.
I think that's low. When is that from? Is that 2025? 2020?
Okay. We need to do a deep research.
Yeah. We need a deep research query. GPT-5.
Okay. We can nerd out on the security budget. There's more to say there, or we can move on to other topics we're hoping to talk about. I'll leave it to you guys.
There's this. Did you guys, we talked about this KYC thing. Is there anything?
Well, I was going to say.
The KYCization of
the
everything?
Internet?
Yeah.
The answer is let's move on.
Well, I don't know. It's a good topic. I'm just mentioning it's another thing that we
definitely want to touch on that. Maybe one thing just to mention that is a bit more of an evolution of this is in addition to the security budget and how much people are paying, the other thing that I'm always obviously very interested in, the thing I'm always tracking very closely is hash rate. And I have been very encouraged. I don't know if you guys saw, I shared with y'all this morning the Capriol tweet. Capriol's, he runs.
I rolled my eyes at it.
Why?
Because I don't think how much it costs to mine Bitcoin determines the price of Bitcoin. I think the demand for Bitcoin determines the price for Bitcoin.
Interesting.
Not just interesting, obvious.
Well, I think perhaps there's a causation correlation difference here, but it's been remarkably on the money for a long time. To me, that's one of the things I'm always interested in, though. That's
because miners are rewarded with the 99% of the revenue is the minting of new money,
right,
which is directly proportional to the price of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So that would explain why hash rate goes up, commensurate with...
Regardless, I'm very happy to see we went over 1 exahash or zeta hash again. And according to him and his production costs, like what it costs in actual just joules, we're at 140 or 145 again. So
I assume this is just a bunch of estimates because we don't know what the actual
power
cost is.
I think he has
some like
public
energy input,
public data, and some private data.
Two things that drive me nuts. One, I do not think the cost of production determines the demand for Bitcoin and thus the price
That's
for
true.
Bitcoin.
Yeah,
this is like a popular argument 8 years ago, and I never understood it. It makes no sense. And then secondly, I don't think hash rate is actually the most interesting metric. It's the cost.
The cost to produce a Bitcoin.
Yes, but the cost to mine. Meaning, let's say we're at 1,000 exahash per second. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous difference if that costs $1 million to do versus $1 trillion to do.
Right.
Because if it only costs $1 million, then like we could go attack the network. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how much hash rate it is. It matters how much does it, what's the financial cost to attack the network?
Right.
And that, of course, changes every year because every year the equipment gets more efficient.
Right.
So from a security perspective, it's the cost to attack the network, not the hash rate.
Yeah, totally. Although it's interesting, if the cost to produce a Bitcoin right now is 140 and people are still mining, that's interesting. It shows people are looking towards the future and bullish.
Is that what he tweeted?
I think so. Yeah. The production cost.
That's not true.
Okay.
It's not very responsive, even if... Like there's got to be a huge lag because you have to like acquire the hardware and deploy the hardware, and like you can't be responsive to just like the market price,
right?
And deploying
it was long term bullishness, right?
Like, but also like there's a myriad of ways to measure how much it costs, and each public mining company gives different figures, and they're always like jockeying for like what makes me look best,
of course,
you know, and so that all depends on what they do well and what they do poorly. They want to hide what they do poorly, but you can have like sort of an all-in cost, or you can have like what's the marginal cost, and in reality, if the marginal cost is where you determine do I keep the equipment running or not,
right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like if I've already like prepaid 4-year energy contract and I can't get the money back, well, so from an accounting perspective, I can amortize that and say, well, here's how much my all-in cost is. But on a day-to-day basis, you just ignore that, right? Mm-hmm. And well, I mean, if you've already prepared your energy and you've already bought the equipment, then you keep it running.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I mean, you calculate how much you're paying the security guard or whatever, but I mean, like, you know, that's negligible. So,
are miners pretty active with like hedging strategies, like trading, say, options in public markets to try to reduce their exposure to fluctuations? Or
I know as much as you do.
My understanding is over time, a lot more of that has happened, which is, by the way, one of the reasons I'm surprised we haven't seen more of a hash rate market emerge. I think it's maybe starting to now. But I mean, increasingly more miners are trying to hold their coins. Like that's definitely a trend. But I think what's interesting about this is, there's a couple of interesting things on this. One, I think he's getting just the electricity cost that he's trying to estimate. So if just the electricity cost of production is 140 a coin, people are still mining. Very interesting. Steve,
there's no way.
You don't think that that's a correct number?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're using an S9.
Yeah. Interesting. I have to go back and check.
I mean, let's do after the show, let's do a little bit of math and show how absurd that is. Or, you know, if he published some.
It's all open source. So it's.
Okay. Yeah.
Tracking this for like 7 years. But, anyways, I think the more interesting thing to me and what makes me excited about this is even in a world where the demand for obviously compute or electricity for AI is like going vertical, and we've discussed, is that going to potentially hurt Bitcoin? It's exciting and good to see that. Okay, no, hash rate is still coming on. There's still people.
Actually, it makes me want to sell my Bitcoin. If people are that irrational, like why? If miners are paying $140,000 just for energy and they keep mining, the system's failed. Like, it's completely irrational. Well,
I think the argument is like there's like only like brief periods where this holds true, and like that's, you know, within whatever, a couple of weeks or a month, you end up like leveling out again. We can look at this and report back for next month. I mean, for next week. But anyways, yeah,
I agree. If the cost of energy is 140K just for a brief moment and then resumes back to like 45K or something.
Well, this,
okay, sure. I mean, but that's not interesting.
These two numbers kind of go like that over time, right? But whatever. Well, we'll report back next week. Steve's skeptical. What's also very interesting to me, though, one story I want to mention on the energy side that's got me very excited is your former alma mater, Google, made a very big announcement this week, which I think is pretty relevant to Bitcoin as well, which, you know, as some people know in the show, we're going much deeper on something hopefully to be announced soon on the energy front. And basically the thesis is just the demand for compute, particularly for AI, has gone vertical. There's no way to supply that much energy to the grid. One possibility is going totally off-grid, which is something that I'm increasingly interested in, something we've seen for some mining as well. But another possibility is if you can keep data centers connected to the grid and you can actually have demand response, which means they turn off. Now, this was a huge sort of part of the thesis from the 2021 paper that we put out with Square about, you know, the ability to turn off miners when price signals say to do that. Awesome. That's like a really well-covered phenomenon at this point. You know, in Texas, they'll shut off when it's really cold or really hot and you need all that electricity. But one of the issues with data centers for compute has been that data centers traditionally require the five nines reliability, you know, like 99.99999% reliability. And Google, I think, announced a major deal this week, which was the first with two different utilities, including TVA, with Tennessee Valley Authority, my old stomping ground, that they are, I don't know all the specifics, but that they're willing to either power down or shift compute loads due to market signals, which is a very big deal. Because now if you can start deploying more of these loads that are data centers that you can actually power down, whatever, a few days of the year, then we can install a lot more on the grid than we
thought. But why do you need to power them down? Is that because like it gets too hot or there's other consumer demand?
For peak demand.
Or hot, Bitcoin mining.
Okay. Like whenever you see extremely, like, for example, like imagine a super hot day in Texas, right? And everyone's got their ACs on.
Yeah.
You basically go and say like the actual cost of our electricity has like gone 100x for just like a few hours. And so in that world, Bitcoin miners were always really valuable because they can just shut off at a moment's notice. They're getting paid more to do that.
So it's like a demand response thing. Correct. And demand response is now making its way to
data
large
centers.
Scale AI data.
But a lot
centers.
Of people were skeptical on if data centers would ever do this because they had this like famous, like, no, we need like perfect reliability and we'll never play ball with demand response.
Several things. First of all, thanks for sharing that. But real quick, like ERCOT, yeah. I mean, ERCOT's an interesting phenomenon because it's a decentralized market and it's like a free market. Which
the freest market.
Freest market, yeah. I mean, so the prices really can go like 100x, right?
Yeah.
Which,
or even 1,000x. Like, you know, people could get bankrupt.
Some people could complain because, like, obviously, if like your energy bill is 100 times more for a week or whatever, that's pretty devastating to consumers, businesses, et cetera. But it reflects reality.
Exactly.
And then, I'm generally pro this because, like, ultimately, we get solutions, economic and technological solutions, like you're talking about.
Yeah.
Which is way healthier than like some kind of like subsidization by the, like through taxes or something. I had not seen that article until you sent it out. First thing I'd say is a good use of AI. Cause I first read the article, like, you know, people would have done for decades and I couldn't find the nugget I was looking for. I wanted to see how are they doing the demand response? Mm-hmm. Because like you said, historically data centers are like,
we'll never shut off.
Yeah. So I wondered if I could, and it's probably in there, but like a quick scan by me didn't find it. So then I just fed it into three different LLMs.
Yeah, that's cool.
And interestingly, one of the three gave me the answer right away. So it's like beautiful, right? I actually forget which, I think it was Claude. Claude beat out ChatGPT-5, which I've been disappointed with so far.
Yeah, we should have that.
And then, and Grok. But Claude pointed out, so I'll give you a couple of examples, and I learned really quickly. One is YouTube, video processing that can be like deferred.
Hmm.
And then the other is like with their AI. So like if it's inference or something, well, you need that to keep running because literally people are typing in a query like I didn't expect a response. But if you're training or something, that can be paused for 2 hours or four hours. And so they do have a couple of examples. So my takeaway from that, first of all, super cool. Demand response. It's going to be super economical for Google because as we've seen with Bitcoin miners, literally in the summer in Texas, Bitcoin miners make more money off of ERCOT paying them than they do mining Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Because it's so there's so few systems that allow being turned off during high demand.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually am more bearish on Bitcoin after reading the Google thing because in my mind prior to that, like Bitcoin was like
the only
unique.
Thing. Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, oh, there's some like legitimate things, expenses and activities that big tech's doing that can be
competitive,
turned off and competitive. So, so that hurts Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Although I think it's going to be a massively growing market and they all win.
Exactly.
But it does introduce a competitor. But it might help because often it validates a market as well. And all of a sudden then, okay, it's acceptable to do that.
It's harder to decentralize the AI inference stuff compared to like going out to like the stranded energy in Africa and collecting some of that to do Bitcoin mining, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, that's actually an open topic as well, is can you have a lot more inference, like really like distributed as well? Today, obviously, yes, because you need the fiber.
I don't see how inference is a, like I just said, inference is not a demand response.
You can. You can just have, instead of it taking you 5 seconds to generate an image you ask, you can have it generate 10 cents. I know companies that do that.
It depends on the kind of inference. Okay.
But then you're actually hurting the consumer experience.
But the
example I gave, AI training is not hurting the consumer. I mean, only in a very abstract way, like, oh, they don't get the next generation model.
It's 20 seconds later and I am so fucking pissed. I think you're going to see all of the above. I think that's where they're going to start. On the inference side, you're going to see, I think, two things play out. One, the deeper I'm going in the energy rabbit hole, like, I have to say, I have just increasingly more and more respect for Google, like, across the board. Like, these guys are like, they're at the very cutting edge. They know what they're doing. They've been doing this for a very long time. But you're going to see, I think they're in particularly uniquely positioned to be able to shift loads more. So as an example, let's say, you know, and I think this is the difference between, let's say, a Google search and, you know, the kind of inference you would do with like a deep research with a Grok or whatever. In a Google search, like my guess is they're going to have like tiers, right? Like the data center that's providing the Google search, they're never going to turn that off, because that is so core to their business that you get that snappy response in 0.01 seconds. But if you're having a conversation in like a deep research, and like, let's say you needed to shift the load to another data center from, you know, Virginia to Minneapolis as an example, and like, okay, that increases the latency a little bit. Maybe it adds 10, 20 seconds. But if you're already expecting it's going to take 3 or 4 or 5 minutes for this deep research to come back, then adding a little bit doesn't really matter. So I expect to see a lot more like shifting of the inference loads as well in different tiers.
But I agree. If a deep research query is 3 minutes, 10 seconds versus, or 20 seconds versus 3 minutes, 10 seconds, it's kind of marginal. But I have noticed the more I come up with a question, I fire off 3 or 4 AIs and like some respond right away with like initial, and like that's, I gravitate towards that. So it really depends on the use case. Also another way to distribute the load here is like, well, if I've got a data center in Texas and it's super hot in the summer, I don't not process stuff for my customers. I just do it in a different location.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Which adds a little bit of time for the latency, but like, again, depending on the query.
But that could even be done at, I mean, it's like, you know, it's going to be hot on July 4th or whatever.
Exactly. So
it's like,
so you're already kind of prepared.
You already, yeah.
And I think, you know, to your point, I think what I expect to see next, and this is my sort of big obsession, is how much can you just take fully off grid? And I think, you know, with certain training, you might be able to go entirely off grid. If you have like a big enough, whatever, like kind of what Elon did with, you know, natural gas as a sort of the backup, eventually solar and batteries. Batteries are a huge part of that. But I think for inference, one of my big sort of questions that I'm exploring now is, you know, instead of having like, okay, I've got 1 gigawatt cluster, could I do whatever it is, 205 megawatt little mini sites? And then the question is like, for the inference, it still needs to be close enough in the city. That you could still get the data back and forth, and like, does that have to use fiber? Could it use satellite? I think that's a very interesting, field for exploration.
Oh, and speaking of decentralized internet infrastructure, I was thinking, because we chatted a little bit about the idea of kind of Helium without the shitcoin.
Oh yeah,
right.
I would love to see it.
And I wonder if we should be part of that change by like, what can we do to create something of like a Presidio Bitcoin access point that you can access the internet through, say, BitChat, not through our typical Wi-Fi, but like a separate access point that you can access through BitChat to kind of demonstrate how to get to the internet without sort of having your own direct access.
Yeah.
But you still need at least one hotspot.
Yeah. Like what I'm saying is like Presidio Bitcoin could be a demonstrate, like the Presidio Bitcoin SSID.
So Presidio Bitcoin could run a Raspberry Pi or server or something like that that connects to the internet, and then it's running BitChat
or even Starlink.
And then the only I can't just like from my laptop or phone Wi-Fi connect to it. The only way I can connect to it is through the mesh, BitChat mesh.
I think I'm saying as a way to demonstrate it as like a viable thing. And then you could imagine maybe it's subsidized because like we already have internet here, you know, but you could imagine that somebody could then take the unsubsidized version and say, pay me.
Well, right? So actually, Steve and I were talking a little about this idea, even taking it further. What would be super dope is you could have that upload point be potentially off-grid as well, so solar and battery powered. So we could actually show a demonstration case where at PB, we have the ability to have the mesh. And then we can even do like a cool thing where we have people like mesh all the way out into like the fields or something, like, and see how, like, try and set a new world record or something. Yeah. And then you've got the off-grid solar plus storage powered either a hotspot or potentially like a Starlink or something where you could just like, okay, you know, Alex is all the way in whatever, the Baker Beach, and sent a message. They got mesh all the way here. And then we send it up to the satellite. That would be, and then have you guys seen Tollgate? This is one of
Tollgate?
The cash. Yeah. So this is one of the cashew projects where you can pay eCash tokens. You can do this with Bitcoin too, of course, but for accessing that. So you could literally payment gate it where like Alex needs to pay to send it across the mesh and then upload it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The vocabulary we should use is just Bitcoin payments.
Yeah.
Specific technology.
Yeah, sure. Fair enough.
By the way, it's funny you mentioned solar, and then people watching right now, if you look in outside through the window, it looks very cloudy.
Yeah.
Which is accurate over the Golden Gate Bridge, but otherwise it's blue sky.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
But still, this is not Arizona or Texas.
Yeah.
We also talked about, or I shared putting a water tower on top of it, like becoming President of Bitcoin could be completely
water different. Tower. I didn't see, that's cool.
Oh, you didn't see my response?
No.
Yeah.
I haven't checked the
whole President of Bitcoin could be completely self sufficient.
I love that.
Have our own water, our own
fuck
like,
yes.
Starlink.
As long as we get the Costco treat delivery, the snacks. Have to get fussed in from somewhere.
TK, don't kill the vibe, man.
Well, we need like a decentralized drone delivery service.
Or like a farm.
Grow our own food.
Grow it.
Okay.
All right.
There's some land out here.
Have I told you guys I have my own garden now? I've started growing spinach and mustard greens.
Oh, great.
I'll bring some.
We could start planting stuff on the roof.
I love it. That would be dope. Solar punk, baby. We're going to have a solar punk future. We're reclaiming it for Bitcoin. I love it.
Okay, before we get on to our next topic, you mentioned Google. Have you guys played with Genie 3 or seen the demos of Genie 3?
No, I've seen the demos, yeah.
No, but I mean, we're living it right now, right?
Yeah.
I saw your tweet. You believe in the simulation more now.
Oh, yeah.
Well, who doesn't?
So we are in Genie. We're in Genie 97 or something.
And then the big question is, who is? Think
only,
on that.
Only some of us?
No.
Okay. Long. Do you want to move on to KYC?
Well, okay. No, I mean, the one thing I think is just, let's do KYC next. But I think the one thing that's worth touching for Genie is, for those of you who haven't seen, and by the way, increasingly, I have to give more and more respect to Google the deeper I go and stuff. Like, you know, everyone else is kind of like, oh, we got chatbots and this and that. And then Google's just always like, oh, by the way, like, here's like the virtual reality world that generates in real time. And if you haven't seen, it's crazy because it has world memory where you can literally like paint walls what they show, step away for a minute, come back, and the world is still painted. One of the sort of, I like read about this in the Reddit Singularity subreddit report, which I like. And one of the jokes in there was, are we going to get GTA 7 before GTA 6? Which DK gets that. I mean, the joke is it takes forever to program video games, but like, could we just like self-generate that world you want before all the programmers are? I totally buy that. And like, I mean, yeah, like if we're about to go into a much more augmented world and let people have their own, you know, whatever visions, I just want to say, I think it's increasingly important that there is a Noster Bitcoin alternative of that world. Because again, I'll never forget, even though I like some of the things he's doing now, the like photo of Zuckerberg got everyone strapped in with their like VR goggles and just like eating the bugs or whatever. And like, if we're going to go into, you know, an infinite recursive loop of simulations, which we probably are in, let's make sure that's free.
So, okay, we'll talk about KYC to internet. And this is it's topical because the UK has a new Online Safety Act law that is having reverberations around the world, and including British people who are running into a bunch of obstacles. But it's just a latest example of like a trend towards KYCing just any basic internet access. Sort of flies in the face of being able to participate on the internet as a NIM.
Yeah.
And anonymous. So
one major question. I mean, it seems like I've started to see a lot more of these things happen. Like, I mean, I've seen some more, let's say, conspiratorial people in Bitcoin Twitter, but is it really conspiracy if it's right? Be like, okay, kind of closing off the exits, shutting down like more access points to the internet. I don't want to get too whatever hyperbolic about it, but like it does seem like a lot of this stuff is like accelerating recently. And I think, I don't know what the trend is. My guess is it has something to do with AI, that a lot of people realize, okay, we're about to have like recursive like learning AIs soon. And somehow that's like sort of increasing the urgency to do this. I don't know. What's your take?
Well, I haven't studied it, but my assumption is that Occam's razor is that it's like trying to save children, like the well-intentioned.
Are you serious? Yeah. Well, I forgot. Was this one packaged as children or terrorism? I forget which one.
But no, I mean, I haven't studied it, so like, I don't know. But I just assume like the people who are coming up with these laws are, I mean, because like in the UK, like 80% of citizens approve this law.
Seriously?
Yeah. It's very popular.
The fuck?
Yeah,
because it's shrouded in a like save children or prevent terrorism.
It's a similar thing that I studied a little bit more about, which is probably a similar pattern. Remember a few years ago, Apple's always taken very strong privacy stances, but they changed their software so that photos on your phone could be in the background without your control, scanned. And then uploaded to the FBI and different intelligence
agencies. I missed this.
I missed that.
What?
I didn't see it. You didn't share it in the group chat. It didn't happen.
Yeah, come on, Steve. Come on.
This is like 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay. That's pretty concerning.
And it's to save children. I mean, it's like child pornography. So like basically there'd be a list of content that is illegal. They lead with child pornography, which the vast majority of people would agree.
No one wants that. Yeah, of course.
That's horrible. And if there's tools that we can use to prevent that, let's use those tools.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do they add next? Right.
So the tool here was okay. A three-letter agency has a list is not provided to Apple. They just get like hashes, and they do
hashes of images,
hash matching.
This is like an image.
So on your phone right now, like it's matching against your photos. And if there's a match, then like you get outed to the authorities and then they'd investigate it. So that was announced and launched, I think, something like 3 years ago.
Damn.
And then they faced massive backlash because obviously that can be abused, because then what you start with something that like almost everyone agrees.
Yeah. Right.
But then like you keep slippery adding slope. More crimes, slippery slope. And also it's just like massively crosses a line where they're like analyze, like I think most humans believe the photos I take on my phone are my property. I don't want the government snooping them, right?
Yeah, I actually didn't think Apple could do that. I mean, I guess
of course they control the software on the phone. Just like with self-custody wallets. I mean, if they want, they can update the software to just like upload everyone's keys to the cloud. They can do that.
Yeah.
So I've gone deep in the debates about like server versus a computer you hold in your hands and a computer that's in the cloud. It's not.
That seems very different to me.
Well,
but when you want a service like, hey, we got to back up your stuff in case you drop it in the ocean.
But I thought that was encrypted.
It sounds like it's in service of the user. But
okay, Levin, let's go there. So like, it is different in some ways, but not. It's just because you hold your phone in your hand doesn't mean you have full control over it. A, you have no idea what software is running in your phone.
Well, it seems like an opportunity for someone to build something that is like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they've been market failures, right? Yeah. Anyone trying to create something privacy oriented is a market failure. But anyway, the point is Apple introduced that, and also with iMessage, some kind of like child protection. So it's just a similar pattern. So I think it's like well intended to protect children. And my guess would be for this law that it is well-intended, trying to save children, and it has like massive popularity and support by the citizens. But all like within a week of launching, I sent that article out. There's like 10 different examples of like probably unintended consequences for adults that make the internet like way harder to use or onerous or impossible to use, or you lose privacy, like situations where you want to ask a question or get information or communicate without revealing yourself, and it puts you at physical safety risk. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden now it's like, oops, we didn't think of that.
So right. We have someone in the chat that also says, BitSimple, Julie Immingrant is Australia's e-safety commissioner. In this role, she leads the world's first government regulatory agency committed to keeping its citizens safer online. So I guess something just happened in Australia too. I guess I would like to believe that, and maybe it's true. Maybe it is just Occam's razor, but it does seem like if it's happening in Britain, if it's happening in Australia, I guess we kind of had Brazil last year a little bit. It's like, I don't know. It does seem like it's accelerating. Maybe it's just the fact that now they can do this, but I guess I would question why is it happening today and not a year ago or 2 years ago?
Well, I think, look, again, I don't know. But there's just more and more data and information now about internet activity, social media, et cetera, and the harms it has on teenagers and children.
Which is also
like, that's
true.
Becoming more evident now than obviously like 10 years ago, it wasn't even a thing. And we now have a body of data. So I think there's plausible answers to all these questions. Now, is it also conspiratorial, part of the big reset? Like, maybe. Either way, it doesn't really matter. Because like, whatever the rationale is, there are these repercussions and concerns that we care about, I think, and we should be discussing. So that's what makes BitChat and Oster very interesting.
Yeah.
I guess you mentioned AI. That could be another driver, right?
Right.
So, which gets to proof of human.
Right.
And we've talked about that on the show, and like, is it even important or not? That's an interesting debate. But we did conclude there's at least certain use cases where it's very important, like dating apps or any app where you're going to meet someone in person. You don't want to be tricked online where you're talking to a bot and, you know,
no catfish.
Either like waste your time because no one shows up, or like it's some other shenanigan or something, right? Or worse. So there it's valuable. And there also might be sentiment where humans just want to know they're interacting with humans, independent of the rational argument that you should be judging it based on the quality of the content or whatever. So how do we get proof of human? We've talked about WorldCoin. We're all very concerned about that. Another is government IDs. So another trend is like, do we see social media requiring passport upload to even use it?
Yeah.
Like, will we see a day where X, like you, just to battle the bots, you have to upload your passport and maybe even like, you know, your utility bill and like super onerous KYC just to participate in social media? And is that going to be driven by corporations or the law?
Or both? Yeah. It's a really good point. And I think it gets to stuff you talked about, which BitChat, like double opt-in friending as proof of humanhood, is like a really important alternative web of trust. And similarly, I mean, I love this Cali, tweet / Noster post where he was just like, look, Noster is becoming so important right now. Like, it's the only free internet left. I think that's probably true. I mean, yeah. And then, I don't know, it makes our stuff more important than ever. What's your take, DK? Do you think this is all driven by trying to defeat the bots?
Which part? Having KYC everywhere?
Yeah, like requiring everyone to put up their ID.
I think people, you know, there's always a good soundbite. And I think a lot of people are very responsive to a good soundbite. So if you say, protect children, you know, get rid of the terrorists, I think a lot of people will hear that, they'll believe it, they'll repeat it. So I think if you want to make progress on this, I think you have to speak to somebody who would be kind of tricked by that soundbite, and not expect them to be one of us who kind of already gets it, but kind of explain why KYC may have some benefits, but it also has some severe drawbacks. And what do those drawbacks look like? So like, I don't know, like what, imagine you have, I mean, I have a neighbor who I think he's generally a good dude, but like, you know, every once in a while we get talking about like fact checking. He's like, well, let's just, if it's, I want to have Facebook fact check things for me. I'm like, that's crazy. You don't want
to. Yeah.
Fact check, like, well, things that are facts are facts. You just be, you know, fact check. It's like, well, yeah, but the interesting stuff is at the edge of what is a known fact. Like, what year is it? It's 2025. It's a fact, fine. But the stuff that's not known, it's the frontier of what is human knowledge, what can be verified. That's the only thing that's interesting. Like, is COVID a thing? Is our vaccines a thing? Like, all of that, those are questions that people should be asking and trying to get answers on. And I feel like it's the frontier of what is well-known and what is not known and possible, where it's interesting to try to digest it. And I think in the KYC discussion, it's similarly like, what is the frontier of where, like, okay, if it's just child pornography or CSAM or it's terrorist stuff, everybody can agree to that. What is the frontier where people might start to disagree? And then can we talk about those cases? Because that's the stuff I feel like I'd like to hear more about. Like is KYC useful? Or like, are I guess you're mostly proponents of non-KYC everything, but are there areas where you'd be swayed to say like, let's KYC some stuff and who should do that?
Well, I think, again, the question is how do you KYC and who's doing it, right? Like, I'm very much, I agree. Like, proof of humanhood is a very interesting thing, or proof of like someone I trust. But I think there's ways to do that decentralized bottoms up and ways to do it tops down. Now, like, are there certain, you know, use cases where, you know, you do want to do that? Look, I mean, I think, again, getting older, like, there are certain cases where, I mean, like, you're the pirate and you're like, the state's always evil. And it's like, well, that's not always true. Like, you know, sometimes the state actually does good things. And like, it's always messy. It's in between. Things are always
shifting.
I'm not
getting to that far, but.
Yeah. Fair enough. Uh-oh. Yeah, exactly. Steve's buttoning up his shirt there. But I just think, I mean, I think that's a good way of doing it. But I also think another way to win people over is to offer, again, incredible experiences that they just won't be able to get otherwise. And so, you know, if KYC sort of shuts down the free and open internet, then, you know, I don't know, the kids want Skibidi Cash, and Skibidi Cash is only available on Noster. Because, I don't know, some lady, you know, who's 60 years old or something thinks Skibidi Cash is bad for the kids. Well, the kids disagree. So let the kids, you know, the kids have Skibidi. I don't know.
Free Skibidi.
Free Skibidi.
That's a good way to end the episode.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Let people have their Skibidi
Cash. Yeah, Skibidi Cash.
Get your Skibidi. All right.
Cool.
Next week then.
All right.
Till next time.
More soon.
That's fun.
All right.